Page 22. December 6th, 1620. The days go on, and here we stay. Sometimes I think the rest of my life will be spent here in this tiny, tossing prison. The men have taken the shallop up and down the coast, making trips in weather so cold that the salt spray froze hard on their hair and beards and clothing. They discuss this place and that place. One hill is too steep for hauling supplies. This spot is too open to the weather. That spot too difficult for boats to anchor. And meanwhile, we wait. The crew complains bitterly that their food will never last them the trip back to England. Oh, if only I were going with them. And yet Captain Jones must stay until we are somewhat established. It is his contract. From time to time, many of the women go ashore to wash clothes or hunt for shellfish and take the children with them so they can run some of their deviltry out. Only yesterday, young Francis Billington, who, though he is but 8 years old, has mischief enough in him for one thrice his age, came across some gunpowder, with which he tried his hand at making squibs in the great cabin. He then found a small barrel, half full of powder, which, in playing with it, he managed to strew about the room. Feeling very manly, it seems he chose a fowling piece, fully charged, and proceeded to shoot it off, creating as terrifying a commotion as I have yet seen. A fire started promptly, and there was a great banging of flints and other small metal things flying about the room. Page 23. And young Francis screaming, and his father bellowing, and men running with buckets of seawater to douse the flames, and women clutching their babies to their bosoms to protect them, and Captain Jones roaring out that it was bad enough he had to spend his days waiting for his praying passengers to decide where they would settle, so he could get back to England, before he and his crew all starved to death. But did he have to have his ship blown out from under him in the bargain? In all this turmoil, young Francis managed to escape and hid himself among the barrels in the hold. 'Twas John Alden who found him there, it being John's particular task to watch out for the barrels and kegs, and Francis was thence delivered by the seat of his breeks to his father. Punishment took place behind closed doors, so I knew it not, but Giles reports that young Francis has not sat down since the doors were opened. Father refers to this episode as the Mayflower gunpowder plot, and speaks of Francis as Guy Hawks. As though we had not enough children on board, even though most of them are better disciplined than the Billington boys, there is one more child now. Susanna White, who is Dr. Fuller's sister, and William White's wife, gave birth to a son. She has been named Peregrine. The poor woman so lacked for privacy that Elizabeth had her brought into our space. I don't know why it is that we should have a bit of privacy when very few others do, but Father has a way of managing things like this, and I no longer question it. In any case, I took little resolved White out on the deck with Demarius and showed them how to catch snowflakes on their tongues and how to see the different shapes when they fell softly on our cloaks. After a while, Elizabeth came out and told us a baby, page 24, had been born. Strong and lusty and already bellowing as well he might, Peregrine, the traveller. Methinks most of his travels took place before he knew of it. Today, December 6th, many of the men set out in the shallop again. They say this is to be their last exploration, and that when they return they will have decided where we are to settle. In truth, I hope 'tis soon. Father says 'tis too important a point to solve without careful thinking. But this life on an anchored ship becomes unbearable. The food is better with fish to eat and wood to cook with, but the air is cold and the tempers of the crew and of ourselves have become short and triggered. We have all lived here in a heap far too long. John Cook has taken to dogging me around, for lack of anything better to occupy him, I suppose, and proves himself a pest. How can a boy with as good a mind as John's act so much like a fool? And he does have a clever mind, His great-great-grandfather was a tutor to King Edward VI, and two of his great-uncles were members of Queen Elizabeth's court. Sir Francis Bacon, of whom I have heard father speak as an excellent writer, is cousin to John's father, Francis Cook. So with all these great minds in his family, 'tis no wonder he is bright and educated. But lately he acts like a true ninny, telling me I have eyes like midnight and wanting to hold my hand. Coming from John, I do not find this as exciting as I always thought I would. Page 25. December 20th, 1620. I was there. I did not see it, but I should have. Even now, trying to write about it, I have put it off for days. My stomach grips in knots of guilt and fright and sickness. It was the day after the men left in the shallop for that last trip, and since none of us knew how long they would be gone, there was usually a group standing at the rail, searching the sea for any trace of the returning. She was there, a little apart from us as always, her eyes searching too. I moved to speak to her. "I doubt they would come back so soon, Mistress Bradford," I said. "If this is to be their last trip, as they promised, they would look thoroughly for the proper place. It may take days." "It makes little difference what place they pick," she murmured. "But they must find good water, and a supply of trees, and a proper harbor." "Oh, yes, I know. Such things are necessary for those who will live here." "It will not be much longer now. When our location has been found, they will start to build a common house first, Father says, and then houses for each family. Just think, soon you will be preparing for your son to join you. Does that not cheer you, Mistress Bradford?" She was silent for a while, staring out at the sea with her gray eyes wide and brooding. Then she put her small, icy hand on my arm. "You are a good child, Constance," she said in that soft, distant voice. "Strong and brave and good. Perhaps if I were more like you." She stopped and pulled her cloak closer around her. "I have been cold so long. It never seemed to be this cold at home. If I could only be warm again, be warm and sleep." She stood a few moments longer while I tried to think of something to comfort the poor woman, but my tongue found no words. Then she smiled her bleak little smile. "You will be all right, Constance," she said. "You were made for this land. You were made for a land like this. Excuse me now. I think I shall get out of the wind." She turned away and moved slowly along the deck to the leeward side. I watched her go, a small, lonely figure. And that was all. It was at least an hour later that we missed her. I think I knew the moment we realized she was not among us. She was so slight. She would have slipped in with barely a splash. I don't know who told Will Bradford when the men returned 5 days later. He shut himself in the great cabin, and Giles, who listened at the door, said he never heard such silence. Hours later, Will came out again and joined the men who had been with him in the shallop. It was then they told us they have settled on the spot for our colony, here where we have anchored. It is to be called Plymouth. Page 27. January 1621. They've actually started building a common house. We can hear the cold ring of the axes carried clearly in the winter air, and the thick, solid sound of a tree as it hits the earth. Even though the women still have little to do, save their usual tasks, there's a feeling of progress that infects us all. The men come back on board at night, so weary they nigh stagger. Yet once they have bolted their food, they sit for hours talking of their plans. Father works like a man possessed, as perhaps he is. He lifts great logs the others cannot move, heaving them into place across the sawpit, where they are cut into thick planks for building. Elizabeth says all the men will catch most fearful chills, do they not take better care of themselves. First heavy work that puts them a-sweating, and then a rest period when they stand in the bitter cold or gather round a fire, burning their faces and freezing their backs. In truth, Christopher Martin confessed tonight that he felt quite unwell. But there are those who think he may be malingering, since he was disposed from governorship at the start of the journey by William Brewster's followers. He has been at times vexatious, finding great fault with what the others decide to do. Malingering or not, he has a fearful cough. Page 28. January 1621 continued. The sailors call it scurvy, and say that they have seen men step from their hammocks, announcing that they are in good health, walk a few feet, and fall dead from the disease. Dr. Fuller gives it no name, but does what he can with bloodletting, and such remedies as the juice of thyme, which he claims to be excellent for irritations of the chest, and lovage, which is supposed to cure any sort of fever. And yet, we are dying. My stomach churns with fear. I flinch at the moaning and gasping and gag at the dreadful stench. Those who are taken ill, and there are more each day, are carried from the ship to the common house, which has at last been built. A few other houses are almost finished, but there is hardly a soul strong enough to work on them. Ours is, at least, a roof over our heads, although the cruel cold seeps in between the many cracks, and I huddle in it most of the day, staying as far as I can from the loathsome sickness. Elizabeth, who must give of herself past all understanding, insists on nursing those poor wretches who lie in the common house, rotting their lives out. "Someone must do it, Constance," she says, "and it is woman's work." "Not mine. I will not go near them." "Then mind Demarius and Oceanus for me, and feed your father and Giles. I will come back whenever I can." "And bring that foulness with you, that we may all die of it? I will go back on the ship and stay there." "There are those with the sickness on the ship now, too, Constance." Page 29. "But I thought they were being brought ashore." "There's no more room in the common house. The floor is already filled with pallets, without a spare inch to lay anchor, save when someone dies. Rose Standish died this morning."
"Rose? Rose, but I saw her just a day or two ago. She was talking to Mistress Mullins."
"Mistress Mullins is dead, too, and her husband lies ill." Elizabeth bit her lip hard. "I cannot stand here idle, Constance. Look out for the babes for me." And with that she left the house and walked down the hard-packed dirt path, disappearing into the commons house. I saw the door close behind her. Father helped Captain Standish bury Rose that night. They dared dig no graves in daylight, lest the Indians see and realize how few we have become. Should they attack us now? And yet if they did, it might be best. It would be an end to all this suffering and filth and cold and fear. For certainly we could not resist them. I said as much to Father when he returned to the house, standing his spade against the wall, where the crumbs of earth from Rose Standish's grave fell softly to the dirt floor.
"What sort of puling, weak-mouthed woman are you?" Father roared at me. "As long as there is one creature alive amongst us to fight, we will fight. We will fight sickness or Indians, it makes no matter which. Now let me hear no more whimpering from you."
I set my mouth tight and went to the hearth, where I filled his trencher with hot boiled fish, silently handing it to him. Page 30. "No, Com, I want nothing to eat," he said, and lay down on the bed without even taking off his boots. I stood watching him in amazement. For Father to refuse his food was unbelievable.
"Are you well, Father? Is there aught wrong?"
But already he lay drowned in sleep and did not answer. Sometime, deep in the night, I heard the thick, choking sound of his breathing, and forced myself to get up from the pallet and go to him. In the firelight I could see his face, flushed and red, and his head turning restlessly on the pillow. Ted Doty heard it too, and came creeping down the ladder from the loft, where he and Ted Leister sleep. He stood beside me, squat and gnome-like, among the half-shadows, and I was grateful for his nearness. "He's got it, Constance," Ted whispered. "The sickness. This is the way it starts."
"What shall I do?" Rouse Giles while I wake to others, Ted. We'll carry him to the common house. But there's no room there. Elizabeth said so.
There must be a place, with so many dying.
No! Don't take him there. If you do, he'll die too. I know he will. Leave him be. I'll care for him.
It's a filthy task, Con. 'Twill turn your stomach. Let us take him.
I whirled on him and knew that my eyes were blazing. Sounding to myself just like Father, I shouted, "You will do as I say. Leave him be. Now help me get his boots and clothes off. He must be made more comfortable. And get more wood for the fire. I will not have him chilled."
Page 31.
"I miss," Ted mumbled, and did as he was bid. My voice had wakened Giles, and all the Father had not opened his eyes at all, and he came shuffling sleepily to the bedside. "What is it?" he asked, yawning. "Is something wrong with Father's?"
"He has the sickness," I said crisply.
"What are you going to do, Con?"
My brother's eyes were wide with fear.
"Make him well. Fetch me some cool water and a cloth, then go back to sleep."
"Water? What shall I bring it in?" Giles asked, gasping at me.
"Bring it in your open mouth, you booby," I snapped, tugging at Father's boot. "Or in your shoe, for all I care, but bring it."
A moment later, the water was there beside me in one of Elizabeth's wooden tankards. But Giles did not go back to sleep. Instead, we sat the night there, one on each side of the great bed. I knew little of what to do for Father, save to bathe him with cool water when his fever rose, and cover him with an extra rug when the shivering took him. When he retched and then spewed, we cleansed his face again and emptied the vile slops. Once he opened his eyes, fixing them hard on me as though trying to see through black mists.
"Leave me be, Con. Leave me be," he said.
His voice was so weak I could hardly believe it to be Father.
"Let someone help me to the Commons House, away from you and the babies."
"You will stay here," I told him. Page 32.
"Thunder, Con, you will do as I say."
"No, Father, you will do as I say. Hush now. You are only wasting strength." The faintest sort of smile touched the corner of his mouth.
"'Tis a sad thing when a man cannot command his own daughter," he murmured. And then, closing his eyes, he lapsed back into sickness.
Giles wanted to take him to the common house. "Dr. Fuller is there. He may have medicines. He knows better what to do."
"Giles, if he goes there, he will die. I know it. I will not have him moved."
"What will Mother say?"
"Elizabeth has enough to take care of without Father," I told him, and then noticed Father's body start its retching and straining again.
"Oh, heaven help us, Giles. Get the basin and hold it, and stop yammering, or else get out."
My brother looked at me as he shoved the basin under Father's chin, giving me one of his long, straight glances, with mischief dancing way deep in his eyes.
"I pity the man you marry, Con," he said. "You're as stubborn as Father, and you fight just as hard. But I'm not leaving."
And that was how the night passed. In the morning I fed Maris and Oceanus, spooning gruel into the baby, whilst Demarius fed herself and Giles fed Father. Elizabeth had had to stop nursing the boy, but he seemed to take the pap with no trouble. Sometimes, late in the morning, Elizabeth came back from the common house, her eyes dull and shadowed with weariness. When she saw Father, she gave a little moan and knelt beside the bed. Page 33.
"You should have called for me, Constance," she said, her hand smoothing his forehead, feeling how hot it might be.
"I knew you were busy. We've done all right. Giles has helped me."
"But 'tis such an unclean thing for you to tend. You wanted no part of it, I know, nor do I blame you."
"Stop fretting, ma'am. There's gruel still hot. Best you have some and then sleep a while."
"Have you slept, Constance?"
"I am not tired." I filled a bowl and handed it to her with a wooden spoon.
"Here, 'twill do you good."
Elizabeth ate, her eyes on Father, He does not seem as ill as some of them, she said. He's better this morning. The little food we gave him has stayed in his belly. She took a few more spoonfuls and then gave the bowl back to me. I can eat no more, child. She bowed her head into her hands, and when she spoke again, her voice was muffled and thick with tears. In spite of all we can do for them, they die. Christopher Martin was the first, and since him Rose Standish, and both Priscilla's parents. Her little brother Joseph lies there now, with no more strength in him than a kitten. Elizabeth Winslow is dead too, and Will White. Baby Peregrine's father? Yes. And both Anne and Edward Tilly sicken more each day. They lie side by side, their hands clasped. I wanted to comfort Elizabeth, to touch her, to soothe her somehow, but I could not. Elizabeth and I, well, I know she is most fond of me, and she is always kind and patient and good to me, but somehow I seem to hold her off. I do not, page 34, want her to be my mother. I seem not to be able to let her love me, or to let myself love her. I do not understand this. I only know that I scorn myself for acting so. And yet I cannot change. I knew at that moment I could have eased her grief with a touch or a word of sympathy. And I could not give them. I could only pull my pallet out from under the big bed and lay a rug beside it. Rest now, I told her. You must rest. Father sleeps, and I will watch him. Poor Elizabeth. She was so tired she could not protest, but fell onto the pallet like a child and slept. February, 1621. Father recovered. I know not how, but he is one of the few who have. A week after he was taken ill, he was able to leave his bed and walk about the room a bit, and then I left him to care for himself and went to the common house to work with Elizabeth and the others. Prissy Mullins' brothers died, and the poor girl is stricken with grief and loneliness, but she has put herself to caring for the small children whose mothers are either dead or dying. 'Tis strange how few of the children are stricken. I know not why this is. Bess Tilly and Mary Chilton help Prissy, and so without Marius and Oceanus to look after, I have been free to help with the nursing. Were there time to think about it, perhaps I might wonder why, after my horror of the awful sickness, I was willing to assist. It may be that after tending Father and finding myself still uncontaminated, my fears were eased. Page 35. Or maybe simply that every hand is needed, and I could not, in all pride, be the one to shirk. Or perhaps this is all part of growing up. In any case, I went. When I first walked into the Commons House, I could not believe what I saw. The floor was covered with mats and pallets, with barely room to step between them, and on each lay some miserable creature, blazing with fever, shaking with chills, or spewing a life out. There was a strange hush in the room, with a constant low sound of weeping, soft moaning, or whispered voices. The great fire which the men kept blazing threw a fearsome flickering light over everything, making a weak hand, raised in suffering, become a skeleton shadow on the wall. For a moment, I stood in the doorway, doubting whether I could force myself to enter. The nauseous stench, the sounds of agony, the nightmare look of the place made me want to turn and run. Then I saw Captain Standish kneeling beside some poor wretch, bathing a face drawn with pain. Looking up, he saw me too and smiled. "Another pair of hands, Constant," he said. "God bless you. Here, empty this basin, girl, and rinse it well. The water is there in the cask beside the door." And that was it. As I carried the cleansed basin back to Miles, I saw John Cook and his father lifting Edward Fuller from the floor in the corner of the room. As they carried him past me, I saw that he was dead. Fuller held the door open for them, and as he watched his brother being taken from the house, his face was wiped clean of all expression. I had just handed the basin back to the captain when I felt a touch on my ankle and looked down. It was Anne Fuller. That was my husband?" she whispered. In the wavering light from the pine knots and the fire, her face seemed all bones with great black holes for eyes. Page 36. That was Edward. I knelt beside her. I could not answer. I just nodded. Sam, my little Sam, is he? Samuel is well, I told her. He is with the other children. Priscilla is tending them. She grasped my hand. Her own was scorching hot the while she shivered. Watch over him, Constance. Little Sam, see he is taken care of. Please? I will. I promise. Try to sleep now, ma'am. She turned her head away from me, and there were slow tears seeping from her closed eyes. The next night she was buried beside her husband. Somehow, I know not how, I was going from one to another, emptying their terrible slops, sponging their faces, spooning gruel into the mouths of those with enough strength left to swallow. There was no time to bathe the dead, nor prepare them properly for burial. We must needs tend the living. Day and night were very much the same, save that we removed the dead by night. Sometimes Elizabeth would be working with me, and Desiree Minter, no time now to gaze after John Alden, and Mistress Brewster, the only one who took time to breathe a prayer over each corpse as it was carried out. Several times I saw John Cook, his face tight with disgust at the chores to be done, helping with a gentle tenderness that did not seem strange to me. It went on for weeks and days, and time meant nothing. There was little talking. No one had the strength to spare for unnecessary words. There was a certain order to our work. There were those who cooked and those who tended the children, 37, whom we kept away from the sick ones as much as we could. There were those who dug the graves and buried the dead. There were those who bore most of the nursing, and there were those who, in spite of everything, continued to build houses. And still they died. And then one night I saw Father coming into the common house, carrying little Maris. He handed the child to Elizabeth, and together they stood gazing down at her tiny little face. I tried to go to them, and something stopped me. They were so alone with her. Elizabeth sat the night holding the baby, rocking her gently and crooning songs without words. All the next day Damaris seemed to sleep, though she turned restlessly from one side to the other, fretting in small, unknowing sounds. Elizabeth went back to nursing the others, stopping by Maris's small pallet each time she passed, kneeling for a moment, her hand caressing the child's hair and her flushed face. I sat with her for a while, bathing her with cool water, trying to ease the fever. Once she opened her great dark eyes and looked at me and smiled a little, and then started to cry weakly, so that Elizabeth came back to her. Sometimes in the night I stretched myself on a bench to sleep briefly, and woke a short time later to see Elizabeth and Father together before the fire. To see Elizabeth and Father together before the fire. Father was taking Damaris from Elizabeth's arms. As he walked slowly out of the commons house, carrying his tiny daughter, I saw the tears that streamed from his eyes, and heard the dreadful sound of a man sobbing. Elizabeth stood watching them go, one hand against her throat. She made no noise, not even when I went to her and held her in both my arms. And the days and the nights go on, and the sick are brought in, and the dead are carried out. Page 38. Mary Allerton died 2 weeks after bearing a stillborn son to withstand the sickness. And the whole Tinker family died, and DeGory Priest died, and Mary Chilton's parents died, and John Goodman and Thomas Rogers and Richard Gardner died, and Francis Easton's wife Sarah died, and John Craxton and John Rigdale and Thomas William and Anne and Edward Tilly died, and John and Bridget Tilly died, and Jasper Morse and his sister Ellen died, and John Hook and Robert Carter died. Dr. Fuller said today he thinks the sickness is ebbing, that fewer people are falling ill. A few or many. What does it matter? Soon there will be none of us left. And who will bury the grave diggers?